All right, this is Mark Gibbons. It's April 10th, 2013, and I'm interviewing Pat Williams about Ed Leahy. So, Pat, I guess the easiest thing to do is maybe try to do a chronological start. Do you have any first recollections of Ed?
You know, Mark, I don't recall when Ed and I first met, but we were close to the same age, about a year apart in school. We grew up together in Butte, and our families, at least my grandfather, his family, were miners. And as it was in Butte, people in that occupation, and there were a lot of them, including me later in life, all knew each other. So Ed and I were acquainted, but I can't say we were fast friends. We were just good friends. We knew each other. We'd laugh together, have a beer together now and then when we were of age. And I always enjoyed, and that's the right word for it, even as a kid, I enjoyed Ed because he combined a roughness with a kindness and a gentleness, actually. Even though he was a big, kind of a rough guy, but he was kind and always civil and gentle. After I got elected to Congress, I hadn't heard from Ed in years, and then I got elected to Congress, and one day an envelope came, a yellow envelope, you know, a manila thing, and there was a note in it that said, Pat, try this on, Ed. And Blind Horses was in
the first little book.
Yeah, Blind Horses, the little book. He didn't have a return address or anything on it, but of course, you know, I knew it was his stuff. I knew about the book, although I didn't have it, but I had looked through it. And so I managed to find his address. That was no easy feat. And then he and I struck up a correspondence after that, not monthly, but 2-3 times a year, and we met up a couple of times or more while I was in Congress and had a beer either at the M&M or the Silver Dollar, and I hope Ed liked me. I know for sure I sure liked him. Years later, after I came back from Congress, it wasn't long thereafter that I realized Ed was in Missoula, and so I looked him up a couple of times. And almost every time I saw him, even long before he was toward the end of his time, he didn't seem to feel very well. He seemed, I don't know, not ill to me, but a little weary, a little worn, a little tired. And he didn't complain, you understand, but he wasn't quite that guy I knew. Of course, the years go by, and I guess I'd forgotten the guy who was 25 years older by the time we hung around a little bit in Missoula together. I couldn't get Ed to talk to me. I remember being in Charlie's bar. It sounds, I guess, from this interview, like the only time Ed and I got together was over a beer, and that wasn't quite the only time, but quite often it was. We got together in Charlie's bar down on Higgins Avenue in Missoula, and a couple of times, and I tried to get Ed to talk to me about words. And
Do you have like a rough estimate of the time frame now? Talking 90s now.
That would have been in the very late 90s, and then into the 2000s. Yeah. I didn't see Ed often, but I'd see him 2-3 times a year. Right. That was about all. But it was in that time frame, yes. Right. So a lot of years had gone by because you see, I left Butte, I guess, long before Ed did. And moved to Helena, then got elected to Congress, and then really didn't get with Ed much until I came back from Congress. And I came back in 79. I was back here in 79. Excuse me, I got elected in 79. I was back here in 97. Excuse me.
Right.
And so I saw Ed in the late 90s back here. I saw him a couple of times when I was in Congress back here. And then in the early 2000s. And that was, so we had a beer or two in Charlie's over the months. And I asked him to talk to me about, what about words, Ed? How do you put them together? And I've always kind of been intrigued by writing, and I read a lot of poetry. I find I can't write it very well, but I still like to read it, and I really liked Ed's stuff. And Ed was kind of aw shucks about his poetry around me. I could tell it was a craft with him, and he was deadly serious about it, and he really struggled with it, I could tell. But at least with me, I don't know how he was about with fellow poets or fellow writers, but with me, the words didn't come easily for Ed to describe how he worked.
Yeah, and I don't know that that's an easy thing to do for any person that does that kind of a thing. But he did enjoy talking about Ed was an intellectual. I mean, so did enjoy talking about his education in terms of philosophy and other writers.
He liked talking about Hugo, who, as I recall, was one of his teachers.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And he liked talking about the lessons he learned from Hugo.
Right.
Yeah.
They were good friends.
Were they?
Yeah. They became good friends. Ed was an older student when Hugo showed up there.
Yeah.
And a lot of Hugo had a lot of influence on Ed's poetry, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I've seen a lot of student poetry from Hugo's workshop time that's a lot like Hugo, but Ed's poetry is Ed's poetry.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's not a copy of Richard Hugo's style at all. I think surpasses that.
Ed was his own person. He was an individual. Plus, he had enough difficult experience that the subject matter was filled with his own subject matter.
Right.
It's not easy to get out in words, I'm sure, but he knew what it was he could write about. Ed and I would talk about politics, which has taken up an awful lot of my life, purposely taken it up. Ed had an innate understanding about politics and a learned perception about politics and government and how it works, when and why it starts to run sour, how important government is, which to him, as to me, is simply a coming together of common people and creating a mechanism called government to get their wishes carried out. That's what all it was. It was a simple thing with Ed.
For the best interest of everybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Ed thought government was absolutely critical, important to the people, trying to figure out what people's wishes and desires were and then bring them to the fore.
I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he was Irish.
Yeah,
you know that whole background of struggle,
right.
and knowing what it was like to struggle against power that you couldn't do anything with, and so America was the great opportunity for the Irish too.
Yeah,
and he was very much a part of that whole philosophy.
My grandparents came from Ireland originally. They came from Ireland, settled in England for a time to get money, and moved to America. But I'm Irish too on my mother's side, and when my grandparents came separately to America and then met and married in Butte, my grandfather was as I said earlier in this interview, was a underground miner, and I've always found a vein of similarity among miners with regard to the need for government, the need for rules and regulations, the need for safety, the need for minimum wage, and the need for being able to come together in these organizations we ended up calling unions. Ed understood that to the marrow of his bones, the importance of all of that.
Right.
Yeah. And he also had a
unerring gut gift of understanding the difference between the workers and the captains. He knew that industry had, and Ed, at least in his conversations with me, did not denigrate industry because of this, but he understood industry had a totally different role in America than individuals did. And the primary role of industry was to operate with enough efficiency to turn a profit. And he also understood that some industries, including early day industries in Butte and mining camps like it, put profit well ahead of the safety or well-being of either their community or their workers. Right. And there was no kidding Ed about that. No. He accepted no apology, shift right and run left from the apologists for industry. He would have none of it because he understood, having grown up in Butte, lived in Butte, he understood the history of what had happened over there. And you mentioned the Irish. I find that among most Irish people, that recognition that individuals acting together can achieve things, including worker safety in this instance, that they could never achieve acting alone. That's why Ed understood the necessity of organized labor, people organizing, they're coming together in this thing, government. I suppose that he and I, if we weren't trading some wry story about Butte or somebody in Butte, we were talking about politics and government.
Right. You know, a lot of his poems deal directly with that business, and he moves very easily between the richest hill on earth and Chile.
Yeah.
You know, because that was, in the 70s and 80s with Allende and all that was going on. I mean, Ed was big into that whole business with the Anaconda Company.
I barely talked to him about all of that. That's interesting to me to hear that, because while we talked about it some, I didn't know that one could assume that was a major interest of Ed, but I didn't talk with him much about that.
Well, he was always interested, I think, in power. He understood power.
Yeah, yeah.
And he understood, like you said, that the only way for people to have any power is to get together.
Yeah.
In the face of it.
One of his a story I told Ed one time, and he mentioned it to me several times thereafter. If I'm recalling the incident correctly, it was this is a story about Jack Kennedy in the White House, and it was right after the Bay of Pigs invasion had failed and been scandalized, and that was the Bay of Pigs invasion by the CIA against Cuba. Eisenhower developed the plan, Kennedy carried it out, and it was a disaster. And I remember telling Ed the story that I had read in one of Kennedy's biographies about a friend of his in the White House, one of his aides, a close, almost lifelong friend of his, who was very down immediately after they had found out that the Bay of Pigs invasion had ended very badly. And the guy was down in the mouth and not talking much that night, and telling Kennedy that he thought the worst was going to happen. And I said to Ed, according to the biographer, President Kennedy put his arm around this guy's shoulder and said, "Ah, Red, buck up, old pal. You know, there's no sense being Irish if you don't understand that in the end, it's not all going to work out right." And Ed, I remember where we were when he said that to him. He put his head back and he laughed, and we were near a bench on the street, and he couldn't stop laughing. He sat down, and then he started to laugh cry. And his eyes got wet, and it was part out of sorrow, part out of the Irish mystique, and part out of the comedy, the funniness of the whole damn thing, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I traveled over in 2008 when Ed got the Governor's Arts Award. And I recite this because I was just so happy, so pleased with Montana that they appreciated Ed enough to give him that award. And it meant more to me than just, a pal of mine got the Governor's Arts Award. It meant that that there was not only a recognition of Ed, but a recognition of the importance of his work in understanding some about the grittiness of mining, the experiences of the miner, the differences between the miner and the people he worked for, the importance of the miners to community, not only their own family and neighborhood, but the whole community of, in this case, Butte, Montana. And Ed was surrounded by friends, you know, when it was over. You may have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get a chance to say hello to him. I looked at him from the gallery. I watched it from the upstairs. Mm-hmm. And I was so pleased that my old pal had been recognized, and I was talking to other folks, and I thought, I don't have to go down and tell Ed I'm here. I don't know if Ed ever knew I was there. I thought, I don't have to go down, because this is a celebration about all of the things that some of us care about, as much as it was the person of Ed. Later, Ed and I talked about that and other recognition he had had, and he said to me, you know, Pat, none of it's about me. It's all about what I wrote about. And I thought back to that Arts Award and thought to myself, yeah, exactly. That's what I thought too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I think that, you know, I was extremely proud of the fact that what he stood up there and said, the first thing out of his mouth was, you know, in the face of the governor and the lieutenant governor and in the old Supreme Court chambers and all that, was, I want to take the opportunity to say two things, since I have this chance, that I am absolutely, unequivocally opposed to capital punishment. And the second thing that I want to say is, war is morally wrong.
I'd forgotten that. I said the latter. Yeah.
You know, there's a guy getting an award for being a poet. And so that goes right back to what you're talking about in terms of, you know, how community, how politics, it's all intertwined. And it was with Ed as well as it was in his poetry.
Absolutely, yeah.
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 Yeah, that was a great day.
I read his poems once in a while. I go back to them. In fact, I had gone back to the book that's the collection of all of his poems about a week before you got hold of me for the interview.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm always appreciative of the sparseness of his words, how they all counted, right? And he didn't have to use too many of them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in that space and in that time, wherever he was at, whether it was a bar or a shaft, walking down the hill, or in a conversation.
I've always maintained that some of the things that are simplest are not easy. Fly fishing, simple, it's not easy. Baseball, simple, but not easy. Poetry, simple, nothing easy about it.
Right.
Yeah. And Ed, simple in the best meaning of the word simple, a simple man, was many faceted, had a wonderful mind, was interested in a great deal more than he always wrote about as his main subjects. He thought he ought to write about those things of which he had some certainty. Mm-hmm. And I think he did. I think he kind of stuck to that.
Yeah.
But he was, he was one of those guys for all seasons. He had a great mind.
Oh, yeah, he was incredibly. You know, I mean, many people have referred to him as a genius, whatever. whatever that means. Yeah, right. You know, and because and as he did, he was incredibly intelligent. I've over this time frame, I've been collecting letters from different friends, and close personal friends, and he was a constant letter writer.
Was he?
Yeah. And I mean, that's an art, right? I mean, that's a lot like poetry, I think. Yeah, right? A really good letter.
Right.
And one of the things that, see, now I'm having one of those brain fart moments. I just lost track of what I was going to say about
you do that, you're down on the main highway, and suddenly you take an off ramp, and now you can't find the clover leaf to get back.
I'm circling right now. But something in those letters, and I don't know if it had to do with politics or what I was just talking about. Well, I listen to this tape, I'll think, oh, I should edit this and put that back in.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
No, but he was an incredible letter writer, and if a person, you know, wants to spend some time in the archive reading Ed's letters, they're as interesting as his poems.
I'm glad to know that. I didn't know it because Ed and I didn't exchange letters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to see him in the hospital. Yeah. I saw him at the end. I mean, he was pretty close, and I kind of knew who I was. I went over and sat in one of the kind of comfortable, sort of uncomfortable chairs.
Right.
You know? And
this was at the Village.
Yes, there. And at the Village. Yeah, and he kind of gave me a half a wave. You know, I think he kind of pointed at me and gave me a half a wave. And, but he was in tough shape.
He was in slow decline for a long time. And I don't know if you knew this or if I told you this before, but I mean, he had, of course, a whole long history of illness and then pharmacology and alcohol. Yeah. You mixed all those things up, and after 60, 70 years, you're bound to, you know, come up with quite a something to deal with. But one of the things that he started developing in the 90s, he started developing what looked like Parkinson's symptoms. Mm-hmm. And he wound up finally being diagnosed, and I'm pretty sure this was like in the really late 90s. He finally went to a doctor who said, he started, you know, because it was Parkinson's, no, it didn't turn out to be Parkinson's. It was false Parkinson's, no, it wasn't the palsy. And this doctor said, were you ever exposed to manganese?
No.
And Ed said, yes, I was exposed to manganese. And he said, well, how were you exposed to manganese? And Ed said, well, he said, you know, when I was, I don't know if he was in high school or just out of high school, but they, in those ore chutes or whatever, they'd dump the ore into, and then it would go down into the cars to be taken off. He said they would suspend some of us guys that would volunteer to do it. They'd put us on a big rope, and we'd stand on a big knot or whatever, and hook your belt or hook yourself to the rope and hold on with one arm, and put a bandana over your face, like a bandana for an outlaw mask kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Give him a 5 to 7 pound sledge in the other hand. And then they'd swing them inside, and they'd hit the sides of those chutes to knock ore down. And they didn't want they wanted to get everything. And so periodically, that's what they did to clean those things. You want to talk about safety?
Yeah.
and of course, that's what, when you look at that description of manganism, the acute symptoms are not unlike depression, all sorts of an array of obsessive compulsive behavior and all kinds of mental illnesses, delusions and so on. And then the long-term or chronic effect later on in life were all the symptoms that Ed seemed to have in terms of this rigidity and a sort of a lack of expression. So you throw all that stuff together and he had some real things to contend with.
Yeah, I have some friends that have been diagnosed the same way. They thought they had Parkinson's and then realized they didn't. They had something else And it's usually related to manganese or some other dust metal over there. I worked in the smelter in the ferromanganese plant, and fumes everywhere. They'd give you a gas mask, but you were right next to these molten pots. You were working right next to these molten pots, and when you had a gas mask on, you couldn't see. Mm-hmm. Well, you'd rather run the risk of inhaling something than burn your leg off up to the knee in this molten manganese. But I worked in those plants, and I've always wondered. I notice if I pick things up on a fork, mm-hmm. Occasionally, there isn't a pea left on the fork by the time I get up to my mouth. I'm sure it's the manganese working in the smelter. Yeah,
I would say that's a good guess.
Yeah. Well, we're going to, and already do, of course, miss Ed, but we're pretty fortunate we've got those words.
Yeah, exactly. And I also have a couple of things that are just sitting there that I need to figure out how to deal with. And his family,
unpublished
his
things,
family has given me permission to either figure out a way of dealing with this or turn it over to the archive. And I plan on turning the basic stuff over to the archive eventually. But I found when I went through his papers, because I had moved his stuff, and then they were either going to the garbage or when I sifted through all this, it was just
imagine.
Oh, it was a classic old bachelor's, dump.
Yeah,
and,
right. Yeah,
and
right.
So I found 40, at least 40 uncollected poems.
Oh, wow.
And some of them were, not the best, maybe, but some of them are amazing, and they're very personal. They're the stuff that was done later in life. Yeah. And I also found an unpublished novel.
Oh, wow.
Called The King of the Cabbage Patch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's over by Holmes area.
It's very similar, I think, in terms of, setting and character to The Thin Air Gang, which is the novel he was had published about the family of bootleggers, So I hope we can do something about that in the next few years.
Well, if I can help in any way, including with a little finances to get something jump started, let me know.
Will do.
Really?
Yeah, appreciate that.
I think, not only all ought to be in the archives, archives have a great purpose, but one of their purposes does not necessarily lend itself to a lot of people reading the material.
Exactly.
And Ed's stuff needs to be out there, and if there's enough to put another small book out, it'd be well worthwhile getting into people's hands.
Yeah. I know. And that's exactly what I thought about here in the last, year or so since I discovered this stuff and started hauling stuff down to the archive and going through papers, is that I need to figure out a way and talk to somebody and kind of come up with some facts and figures and see what we can do to get this out.
Well, if you could, if you could get it going and see what you need, including, like an intern in the university,
right.
The creative writing department, poetry folks would be glad to give you help, I think.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, or maybe
I know that right now, with the Mansfield Library, that they're transcribing all these interviews that are being done.
Great.
So the people have them in written form.
That's great.
So I think that, that's something that shouldn't be too difficult to do.
Yeah.
And then once that is done, like you say, it may have to be an intern, because I think an editor and the intern are going to have to sit down together.
Yeah.
What I'm looking at is it's typed, it's hand typed, and then it's also
edited, sort of
hand edited. Yeah. And then you're going to get that, and then you're going to decide, an editor is going to have to come in and make a couple of choices here and there.
I asked her one time, I said, how often do you have to go back over it until you get it right? Meaning editing.
Yeah.
And he said, you don't do it enough times. You just stop eventually.
Exactly.
And of course, that's correct, isn't it?
That's right. Poems are never finished. They're only abandoned. Somebody said that.
I like it.
And everybody steals that.
No, I still write occasional columns for the newspapers. I used to write them regularly, and I still do them, but not as nearly as often as I used to. And I finally just turned them in. I finally just have Sam done, turned it in.
Right.
I've rewritten it 9 times, over and out.
Right.
Check and send.
And most people are going to enjoy it anyway. And the snipers, they're going to always find something to shoot at anyway.
I've noticed that. I
know, no problem there.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, Patty, if I don't think, is there anything else that you want to say about Ed in general?
Oh, I think we've, you know, at least explored some of it. Ed's a deep subject, but we've explored some of it.
Yeah. And like you said, I think the best part is available to us in print, and then we came out of the mouth of Ed.
Yep.
All right. Over and out. Thank you.